Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 322 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Valerie Gillis speaks with Doug Johnston about poetry's place in Scottish life, her multidisciplinary practice inspired by studies in 1970s India and ongoing collaborations, and her role as a practitioner in arts-based health work.
Valerie Gillis is a poet and writer of non-fiction, whose themes include observation of the natural world, the environment and awareness of place. She has published 8 volumes of poetry and contributed to many anthologies. She is well known in Scotland for her cross-media work with visual artists discovering ways in which poetry can grow from the landscape. As the recipient of a Creative Scotland Award in 2005, Valerie travelled to the healing springs and wells of Scotland and Ireland to write new poems inspired by the sonic signatures of these locations. Her 3-year journey became the source of The Spring Teller, published by Luath in 2008. Her most recent book, The Cream of the Well, also published by Luath, was shortlisted for a Saltire Award in 2015. Valerie was the Edinburgh Macker, Poet Laureate to the City from 2005 to 2008, and an Associate of Harvard University between 2009 and 2015. She is the facilitator for the creative writing and journaling groups at Maggie's Cancer Care Centre in Edinburgh, and a trainer for Lapidus, using the literary arts for healing and well-being. Valerie Gillis, welcome. I was absolutely fascinated reading your CV and everything you've done. It's an incredibly diverse body of work and experiences as well. Mm-hmm. But you grew up in Edinburgh and Lanarkshire, am I right in thinking?
That's right, yes.
So how were you exposed to poetry in the first place? Was it a poetic house?
Well, in the sense that in my grandparents' house, the local farmers would call in and recite Burns at New Year, so then stagger off into the night. So the poetry was living in that sense. It came orally. But before that, we had lots of poetry in primary school and enjoyed reading poems. You know, this is it on the book, mm-hmm. on the page. So that was kind of different.
Well, interesting. Burns is kind of, you mentioned Burns there. Mm-hmm. I mean, even when I was at school as well, Burns was omnipresent in primary school onwards. There's competitions and prizes for...
Yes, it wasn't quite as much, I think, mm-hmm. in Edinburgh of those days, because he was regarded as quite a dangerous character. But I think since then, I think Burns, you know, everybody enjoys, particularly the songs have made the poetry popular.
Well, I always think that in Scotland we have a slightly different relationship to poetry than they do in other parts of Britain, I think. Do you think that's right?
I think we have definitely more a kind of indigenous tradition of poetry. My grandfather, for example, he was a speaker of Scots, and he would read Tennyson and Dunbar in the evening to himself. Mm-hmm. So there was that respect for literature of the long distant past, which I think we've been quite good at keeping that going. And I think also we're very conscious of who's alive and writing now, more so maybe than other places. Maybe not more so than Ireland.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe they've got the jump on us. Maybe
they have. Yeah, they have indeed. Enough. I think.
And so, how did you come to be writing poetry? Was that at school you were?
Yes, it was while I was at school. I remember exactly when it was. I used to spend weekends with my grandparents and help around the place. They had horses and hens and all that kind of thing. And the country around side was pasture land, it was moorland. So you could go anywhere you wanted. The local farmers would recognise who it was, and nobody ever chased you away from the hill. So I used to go wandering off, and I would just listen to the wind. And suddenly one day it was raining, and I began to compose this poem away up the hill about the rain. And I got back and wrote it down afterwards. So that became a kind of template for how I worked for many years. I would make things up when I was out, and I would write them when I came back home. Mm-hmm. I had an English master who actually came from the Isle of Lewis. He was very encouraging to all of us. He wanted us to enjoy poetry, and he taught it really well.
Mm-hmm. That can make a big difference.
Yes, yes, I think so. And obviously he came from an oral tradition in Gaelic, mm-hmm. so the way he put poetry across was often very immediate, and yes, it was good.
Well, that's interesting that your first ever poem came from an out-of-doors experience in nature, mm-hmm. because that is obviously a huge theme mm-hmm. Across all your body of work. Is that still how you compose poetry, out in the outdoors?
Yes, I would say every morning I'm out walking the dog, and I do that nowadays before I write. Something about getting the fresh air and yeah. starting to think and observing everything when you're out. So
there is some scientific evidence, I think, for that, the fact that people come up with creative solutions or creative ideas when doing something physical. You know, yes. whether it's some physical activity, walking or hiking or running or swimming or whatever.
Yes.
I think that's absolutely key. And I think that's a secret for a lot of writers, actually. They come mm-hmm. up with, like, people who come up who have plot problems in novels will often, I find that the knots will untangle when I'm out for a long walk or something like that.
Yes, yes. It must be the oxygen.
So back to your earlier years. You studied at Edinburgh University mm-hmm. initially. Am I right in thinking you met Norman McCaig, was he?
Yes, he was our writer in residence when I was in final honours English.
That's quite handy.
And he was, you know, one of the first writer in residences mm-hmm. that university took on. And he, for many years, had been a primary school teacher, so his teaching was very direct, and he told you how he wrote, and he would look at your work and maybe shake his head or maybe nod his head, and you okay. knew what it was all about. And he also had studied classical literature, so he used to suddenly say, "Study brevity." And you'd think, oh, that's what I must do. So obviously that's why I've never become an epic poet. And yes, he used to say, you know when you want to write because it's like feeling hungry. You recognise the feeling that you want to write.
Okay.
So that was helpful.
Yeah.
And some of these tips that we wouldn't have got from any of the academic staff, mm-hmm. certainly all of us got from him, and he organised times when we would meet local writers and, in fact, national writers who all knew Norman. They would come in, take the students to the pub.
Great. So, what an education!
That was it. Yes, it was. It was.
But then at one point, was it after that that you were studying in India?
Yes, when I finished my first degree here, and I thought, not going down the regular route of studying somewhere else in the UK or America or whatever. And I really wanted to go to India and was very interested in Indian culture, particularly South India. Mm-hmm. And I was awarded a Commonwealth Scholarship to go and study at the University of Mysore, which is a Hindu university.
Okay.
And in those days, because this was 1970, there weren't really any foreign students. They were South Indian, they were Hindu,
yeah.
they came from very traditional culture. So it was definitely an immersion experience in the way people thought and regarded art in any form, including poetry. And I'd gone there, well, set out to study R.K. Narayan and Raja Rao, great novelists mm-hmm. of a kind of Commonwealth tradition, because they ended up living in other countries. Raja Rao lived in France, and R.K. Narayan lived in the West Indies. And they did revisit India, and I met them as a student, mm-hmm. which was just a tremendous mm-hmm. experience. You
yeah.
know, you meet the guy that wrote The Serpent and the Rope, and you think, whoa, reality and illusion are in the room. So that was good. And the professor that I studied with was called Sidi Narasimhaya, which means the man like a roaring lion.
Wow.
But he was very scholarly and very keen that I should start by studying the Jataka tales and by going to classes in Indian aesthetics. So
okay.
This was the beginning of the combined arts for me, which I'm still working on today. It was an understanding, you know, actually going to events where I saw how in South India all the arts could come together.
Well, that's interesting. It sounds like it had an absolutely profound effect. And like you mentioned there, that way that you combine art forms has been absolutely central. It's kind of like a holistic approach to art and creativity, I think. And that seems to be something that drives you even more now than it did in the past.
Yes, because I think it's been something that has developed tremendously. Now we call it cross-media and we've got people filming it as it's happening. And it has come away, and where the arts seemed to be very separate at one time in my youth, they now seem, you know, you thought it was something amazing that a letter carver would carve somebody else's words. You know, what relationship is there? But now it's all seen as integral, and there's a kind of organic meeting of the arts, I think. But it's taken a while.
Do you feel like the world's finally catching up with you?
No, they're catching up with the early centuries in South India.
Yeah, okay. Maybe they have the idea, but all of that stuff, you've had 8 collections of poetry, I think, something like
yes.
that. One of the ones I want to talk about is all of the stuff you've talked about there kind of comes together in the Spring Teller, which came out in 2008.
Yes.
Which was, you tell me a little bit about what that project was, because it's fascinating.
Well, the Spring Teller began by taking a walk down by a river that's near here, and there's a well, which is, it's kind of strange because it's right at the edge of the river, and it's a drum of masonry, and you can hear the well inside. So I was walking down the river, and I'm hanging my head down inside this well, and I'm thinking, that sounds really different from the water in the river. I wonder if it sounds really different from all the other wells. Also, what reminded me so strongly of poetry, because it's coming from underground. You don't really know where the source is, and it wells up from those depths. So I thought, now I need to find out if there are more springs and wells and how they sound, and record them and go and then ask people who live locally how the well's been used, how it appears in folklore, what's the history of it, do people come to it today, is it still active? So I set off with this, and I was already working in the hospital arts, and I thought, well, this also, there can be an outreach from this. The things I learn from people along the way, I can bring back into hospital arts work and make workshops out of them. So the main time was spent going around all these different wells in Scotland and a few in Ireland, because there's so many there, and hearing people's stories and finding them and mapping where they were.
It's so fascinating, because it's so much more. So there's a book of poetry comes out of this.
Yes.
I mean, but that's kind of only a tiny part of it, really. I mean, you're talking about a kind of social history as well, a kind of community outreach project, and there's a map, and actually, one thing you started talking about here, which you didn't really develop on, is that you recorded the sounds of all the wells, didn't
yes.
you?
Yes. The recordings could have been better today, but then they still picked up the surroundings of the well, people talking, birds singing, sheep bleating, cows lowing, squelchy wellies coming through.
That's absolutely terrific.
So it was fun.
And it's kind of, like you say, some of these are, you know, disused or kind of lost almost, but it was kind of a way of recovering that knowledge, wasn't it?
Yes, and I think it's just part of a general awareness, which is ecologically friendly, and people are aware that these water sources, we've said we don't need them now. Let's just wait and see.
All that kind of knowledge might come in handy.
It might indeed, and it, you know, it gives a kind of strong evidence for refusing things like fracking and say, no, this will be seen from outer space if you disturb the water tables, and you know, it'll all be very different. And I think in the past, where people didn't have doctors or couldn't afford doctors, but they knew different wells that had different mineral properties. So if you had rheumatism, you went to one. If you were anemic, you went to another one, and it was kind of folklore.
Mm-hmm.
But you would make that journey for your cough to a certain well, which was associated with people getting better from what you were suffering from. The eye wells were very famous. And I remember chatting to an American eye surgeon who happened to be travelling through the Highlands and was having dinner with friends, and said, so what wells have you looked at? And I said, looked at some of the eye wells. And he said, what's in them? So I was talking about some of the minerals, and he said, that's exactly the kind of eye salve and eye drops I make up for my private patients.
Oh. So he knew all along.
It's been known.
Yeah.
And it will resurface, yes.
But that's really interesting. One of the things you were talking about there, you've always been very interested in nature, not as a kind of separate entity, but as how humans interact with that nature specifically. Mm-hmm. And that then led to, I mean, we talked about your holistic approach to poetry and other elements of creativity. And that led to you, I mean, you've worked with a number of different visual artists, mm-hmm. a textile artist, Anna S. King.
That's right,
so
yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, Anna is a national treasure. Who works with all kinds of materials.
Mm-hmm.
She's a weaver, and she makes big tapestries, and it's all hugely tactile with different materials. But she's very knowledgeable about the natural world and has worked in several of the botanical gardens. So what we would do, I would go down to Doic with Anna. And
there's a botanic garden.
Yes,
in the Wardens, in the Borders.
A branch. That's a lovely description. A branch, of the Edinburgh Botanical Gardens.
Yeah, right.
So we collect leaves and feathers and anything that was on the ground. We weren't allowed to take anything off the trees or off the plants.
Okay.
It's more like a wonderful woodland garden, Doig. And we would gather some birch bark, and we'd come back, and Anna would make some ink, and I would write on the birch bark.
She would make ink?
Yes, she can make ink,
okay.
Or she can use a bit of indigo for this and that.
Right.
You know? So we could do that, or sometimes we'll say, no, this is really important, we'll use archival ink, so it will last forever. What a hope. But we would see what each person focused on. So it's very interesting working with another artist where you're both looking at one thing, but you see it differently.
Okay.
And that just opens a whole scopy kind of view of it, and then you can begin to work and begin to make.
So what's the end product of that? It's almost hard to pin it down.
Yes, it was an exhibition which was in the gardens for a whole summer, and there are lots and lots of visitors there,
mm-hmm.
who would wander through the exhibition and then out into the gardens. And sometimes it's, you're almost opening people's eyes to what they're about to see,
okay.
and make them more responsive to nature itself by saying, look, these guys are using this and this and this, and it all came from here.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you do notice things, or you could go to the gardens first and then to the exhibition.
Yeah. You've had a number of other collaborations with other visual artists, sculptors that are kind of site-specific as well. And the one that I was fascinated reading your biography was with a harp maker, for a wind harp or something.
Yes, or you can see it in the Edinburgh Botanics.
Yes, I haven't noticed that, but I'm definitely going
to
try.
You need to go on a windy day.
Okay.
It's set in its own little pavilion, and it's a wind harp made from a mighty elm that fell in the Botanics after Dutch elm disease.
Okay.
But they tried to save the wood of the elm and give it to different craftsmen to make things. But Mark Norris, who makes harps, the Scottish Clarsa for harp,
mm-hmm.
players, was given the commission to make a wind harp, which is in a slightly bigger scale and is played by the wind. when the wind reaches a certain velocity.
Wow, that's a terrific idea.
Unfortunately, it's loudest when the wind is so dangerous that the gardens are closed.
Right. What's your input into that?
Mark asked me to compose a poem that people would read about the wind.
Okay.
And he wanted it to be the harp speaking to the wind,
okay,
or inviting the wind. So it really became a little poem inspired by folk rhymes that talked about the four different winds and
right,
what they brought. So it's probably the piece of poetry that thousands and thousands of people have read as they wander.
Because it's in the Botanic Gardens.
Yes.
Great.
They stop and read it, and it's just 8 lines long.
Okay.
Which is good, because people will read that.
Yeah. It's not an epic poem.
No.
So one of the things that you mentioned in passing is that about you use poetry as a way to help people in sort of therapeutic scenarios.
Yes.
You work for Maggie Centre at the moment, but you've done that for in other places in the past. How did that come about, and what do you actually do?
Well, it all began a long time ago when some patients in a hospital in Haddington were given some funds to edit a magazine, and they wanted to bring somebody in who would help them edit their work. So that's how I got involved, because they asked me in. And after that, ArtLink asked me as a writer to work on some projects in psychiatric hospital and general hospitals. So that's really about 20 years ago now.
Okay.
And I worked with a wonderful photographer there, and we would produce exhibitions in the wards for people, so that we would set them up within the wards and people would take their own photographs and do their own writing. And then I started to work for Maggie's Centre, which is a cancer care centre offering lots of tasters of things which they believe that they have evidence to show increases people's chance of recovery and increases their enjoyment of life, their recovery from the grief and trauma of their experience, the general difficulty
mm-hmm.
of these diagnoses and the treatments. And so many people coming to Maggie's are in the middle of treatment,
yeah,
or won't be here next week because they've got surgery, but they'll be back the next week. So that just that tiny voice, I'll be here in 2 weeks' time,
mm-hmm.
I'll be here in a week, that hope that's there, it is all about hope. And about beginning to see the world afresh and to see the not so frightening things. Maggie's garden, Maggie's trees, Maggie's all the flowers and shrubs out that we often write in the garden. And it's a beautiful modern building with perfect spaces for workshops.
Yeah.
And the groups help, you know, people help one another. I'm there and I often work through the medium of poetry. So to relax people at the beginning, I'll recite a poem, not mine, I have to say. The poems I use are ones that I've found work for people. They could be something like John Clare, Charles Cosley. Maybe there'll be poets who wrote quite a while ago, but they have a rhythm and a sense of continuity, which is important for people.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes there'll be someone who's writing out of a difficult experience and which people can identify with.
Yeah. That must be incredibly rewarding for you during
mm.
that experience as well, being able to see the kind of real-life health benefits that, that creativity
mm-hmm.
can bring.
It's amazing. I often feel how little I need to do. I'm a sort of presence that
yeah.
brings the poem or the story that we're looking at and offers it round the group, and then people are writing their own things and it becomes a weaving of something supportive around the group.
And at the same time, is it ever difficult emotionally in that
Oh yes,
space?
Yes, it will be. But sometimes I like yesterday in Maggie's, I just liked passing round the water for everybody's glasses. And I think to myself, of all the springs I've visited, and here I am to pour the water for them and make sure that people are not going thirsty. So.
One last thing I want to talk about is, what's next?
Ah.
Because I mean, it sounds like you're always incredibly busy. So I'm really interested to know what kind of projects you're working on at the moment.
It's my friend Rebecca Marr, who's a photographer living in Orkney. We're going to be working partly in Orkney, and I'll also be in the Hebrides and writing about a new theme, which I daren't speak about, or it will all never happen to me.
It'll disappear in a puff of smoke.
I'm quite superstitious about that. Okay. You know, the magic of it. If you talk about it, you can't write about it. I think most writers find that, you know, the writing is the talking, in a way. Yeah. Yes.
Well, then, I think that's a good place to finish up. Thank you very much for your time, Valerie Gillis.
Thank you, Doug.
That was Valerie Gillis in conversation with Doug Johnston. You can find out more about Valerie on her website at www.valeriegillis.com. And that concludes episode 322, which was recorded by Doug Johnston and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 323, Linda Cracknell follows Robert Louis Stevenson to France, and Dan Richards visits Tove Jansson's Finnish archipelago. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.